DW Africa Link.
Hello, it's Tuesday, the 18th of September. A very warm welcome to Africa Link. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And I am Wanjiko Mwaura. Don't forget to join us live on our Facebook page, that's DW Africa. And please leave us your comment and share.
Coming up, Amnesty International on the decade's new video showing escalation of horrific violence in Cameroon Anglophone region, this time citing a graphic video of a beheaded security officer.
This video is another indication of the brutality of the armed separatists. We have been able to authenticate the video, which show the decapitated body of a gendarme killed by armed separatists.
And Zimbabwe's opposition walks out on President Emmerson Mnangagwa's first State of the Nation address, saying,
"When a leader gets elected, the stock exchange shoots up and people make money. But in this country, prices are going up and we're dying of cholera."
Plus, counter accusations as a Russian plane is shot down near Syria's sea coast.
These stories plus lots more coming up later on the show. But first, let's hear the news in brief.
DW News.
I'm Sertan Sanderson with DW News. The United Nations has published a report saying that it estimated at least 10,000 people to have died under the military crackdown on Myanmar's Rohingya population in 2017. UN investigators said that Myanmar's army had used, quote, unfathomable levels of violence against the minority, calling for the military to be removed from politics. UN chairperson of the Independent International Fact-Finding Mission on Myanmar, Marzuki Darusman, spoke of grave human rights violations that may cross the threshold of crimes against humanity.
"Our analysis leads us to conclude on reasonable grounds that in Kachin, Rakhine, and Shan states, the underlying acts of crimes against humanity have been committed as part of a widespread or systematic attack directed at civilian populations."
The document also says that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the atrocities were committed with the intention of destroying the stateless Rohingya, warranting charges of genocide. Myanmar's ambassador to the UN, Kwai Motun, meanwhile criticized the 444-page report as being one-sided and flawed. An Iraqi man detained over the fatal stabbing of a German national in the eastern German city of Chemnitz has been released after a court hearing. Prosecutors could not find any evidence linking the suspect to the murder. The 22-year-old was detained along with another immigrant on suspicion of stabbing to death the 35-year-old German man last month. The killing had triggered large anti-immigrant protests and counter-protests in the eastern German city. You're listening to DW News. Nigerian authorities say that at least 100 people have died in flooding after heavy rains in recent days. That number is expected to rise. Fatalities have occurred in at least 10 states. A national disaster has been declared in four of the worst-hit states. The Nigeria Hydrological Service Agency and the Nigerian Meteorological Agency both say that rising water levels will exceed those reached in 2012, when flooding killed 363 people and displaced over 2 million. Water levels are expected to continue to rise if water is released from the Lagbo Dam in Cameroon. Moroccan authorities are clamping down on migrants from sub-Saharan Africa in the port city of Tangiers. Hundreds of migrants trying to escape poverty and violence in their home countries were seen fleeing to forests around the city to escape the police raids. There have been reports of police seizing their belongings, burning their camps, and forcing them onto buses heading to the south of the country and away from its northern border with the Mediterranean Sea. Rights activists say that the crackdown on migrants is the biggest since 2015. And for more news and information, please log on to dw.com or download our app. I'm Sertan Sanderson.
This is Africa Link with me, Wanjiko Mwaura.
And I'm Zipporah Nyambura. Thank you to all of you listening to us on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Many of you already talking about the story on our highlights about Cameroon. Clovis Bex is talking there about the military. Tiango Lucas also commenting on the story. And that is exactly where we're going to start.
That's right. We start off in Cameroon, where Amnesty International has authenticated a video showing brutal attacks against ordinary people and security forces in the northwest region of the country. In the new video, confirmed by its forensic experts, separatists are seen with a decapitated head of a policeman with bruises on it.
The Human Rights Watchdog is now calling on the Cameroonian authorities to urgently and effectively investigate the violent incidents, which they fear could escalate ahead of the general elections. I talked to Ilaria Allegrozzi, a researcher with the advocacy group at Amnesty International.
We have received both videos through our contacts on the ground, and we have been asking questions regarding where these videos come from. And after analysis, we have been able to authenticate the video, which show the decapitated body of a gendarme killed by armed separatists, most probably in the northwest region of Cameroon, where this group is operating.
In your view, what does this video tell us about the atrocities happening in the Anglophone region of Cameroon?
This video is another indication of the brutality of the armed separatists, groups which have targeted both the security forces, killing hundreds of them since the beginning of the crisis, and the ordinary people. They have targeted people who are suspected or are perceived as supporters of the administration and the security forces. They have attacked, for example, teachers, students, and traditional chiefs suspected of collaborating with the administration.
It's not the first time Amnesty International is talking about the rising violence in this part of Cameroon. Do you think anyone is listening, or have you seen any action actually being taken?
We have published a report in June about the Anglophone crisis, warning about the escalation of violence both in the north and southwest. We have launched many warning signs, and we have been calling for action to be taken by authorities in order to open investigations on the crimes we documented. Unfortunately, we have seen very little steps taken by the authority to address the impunity. Still, the lack of accountability is fueling new violence and new crimes.
Ilaria Allegrozzi, a researcher at Amnesty International.
Now, still on that report, Cameroonians in the Buea region have been talking with DW. Let's take a listen.
You know, war looms in the peripheries. No one can deny that. You see troops entering. What are they coming to do? And there are threats. People will threaten you that war is coming. And we have watched people die when they are not supposed to die, and you stay. There is always a better way out of every situation. If you can watch our kind die for our own egos, I don't know where the world is heading.
Killings indicate that the war is really serious, and there's a need for an urgent solution from both parties. I mean, ceasefire before we go to dialogue or whatever they will call it.
Everybody is fleeing away from town. If you move from my 17 to Moluko, you can barely find people along the road. We are just managing. It's not moving anymore.
Those are the voices of people in Cameroon, Buea region, giving their reactions on what is happening there. And now we go to another story which is making headlines around the world, and it's Russia, which is blaming Israel after a military plane shot down off in Syria. The Russian military aircraft dropped off the radar over the Mediterranean, leaving 15 people dead.
The incident happened shortly after Turkey and Russia announced a deal to set up a demilitarized zone in Idlib, Syria. Tabea Goplet has more.
Although details of what transpired remain vague, there have been a lot of counter-accusations on what exactly happened. Russia accuses Israeli forces of conducting a bombing raid in Syria and using the Russian plane as a cover. The Russian plane was then mistakenly downed by Syrian air defense as it attempted to target the Israeli jet. Russian Defense Ministry spokesperson Igor Konashenkov did not mince his words.
We see the provocative actions by Israel as acts of hostility. As a result of the irresponsible actions of the Israeli military, 15 Russian service personnel perished. This absolutely does not correspond to the spirit of Russian-Israel partnership. We reserve the right to take commensurate measures in response.
However, Israel has denied the accusations that it used the Russian plane as cover, leading to its shooting down. In a statement, they said, quote, Israel holds the Assad regime, whose military shot down the Russian plane, fully responsible for this incident. Israel also holds Iran and the Hezbollah terror organization accountable for this unfortunate incident. For several years, Israel and Russia have maintained a special hotline to prevent their air forces from clashing in the skies over Syria. Russia has been a key supporter of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and has two military bases in the country, while Israel, which has refrained from taking sides in the Syrian civil war, has acknowledged carrying out scores of airstrikes against archenemy Iran and its Shiite proxy Hezbollah.
That was Tabea Goppelt with that report. We now head back to the African continent and direct to Zimbabwe, where the country's main opposition members earlier today walked out on President Emmerson Mnangagwa, during his first State of the Nation address in Parliament, accusing him of stealing the July 30th election.
But as Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare for DW, the 75-year-old carried on and promised to take the Southern African country out of its economic crisis.
Those are MPs from the opposition Movement for Democratic Change Alliance outside Zimbabwe's parliament denouncing President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who had just entered the building to deliver his first State of the Nation address since the July 30th election. Tabita Kumalo, the spokeswoman for the opposition, explains why they walked out on President Mnangagwa.
All what we are saying is, prove to us that you won these elections. And secondly, you are even failing to run this country. People are dying of cholera in the 21st century. No ways. When a leader gets elected, the stock exchange shoots up and people make money. But in this country, prices are going up and we are dying of cholera. He must attend to the needs and wants of the people of Zimbabwe.
As if he was listening to the cries of the opposition MPs outside the parliament. In his less than an hour-long speech, President Mnangagwa said he wanted to use his first five-year term to prop up Zimbabwe's economy, which has been on a free fall for nearly two decades now.
My government stands committed to deepen its democratic values and aspirations for the prosperity of our country. My government is indeed heavily perturbed by the current outbreak of waterborne diseases, such as cholera and typhoid. It is regrettable that this has resulted in the wanton loss of life.
Critics say the Zimbabwean government has failed to deal with the cholera outbreak, which has so far killed more than 30 people since the beginning of this month.
Our very own Columbus Mavunga reporting there from Zimbabwe.
Now, our top story, Africa today, was Cameroon. And just recently, the government donated $18,000 to support UN Center for Human Rights and Democracy. And lots of you have been sending in your comments. Bruno here says, the same Human Rights Commission that said they were not given permission to investigate? Well, what do you think?
And Chima Ucha says a government accused of war crimes, that includes human rights violation, donates money to an international organization that ought to protect human rights, and he says that is wrong.
And Soli Makosa also adds, then you wonder why the UN is silent when scores of innocent people are massacred. And he adds on a very long comment there, which you can find on our Facebook page. That's DW Africa, which we invite you to join us on.
So lots of bashing there on the UN. Of course, someone else is saying, I don't see any need for the UN in the world today. It is not a champion of doing the right things. So thank you very much for your comment. You can also contribute on DW Africa. You are listening to Africa Link, coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
With me, Wanjiku Mwaura. Remember, if you're interested in any of the reports, please go over to our Facebook page, DW Africa. Leave us a comment and we shall try and read some of them and also respond to you.
Coming up in the next 15 minutes, we will hear how the youth in the Gambia are transforming their community through street lighting.
Looking at our streets before, the place was dark. When it's dark, you don't have that freedom, and there's that risk of you being attacked. So now, I can say people are much more free. It's like daytime.
Indeed, you have to stay tuned to hear more of that report, and we still have lots more packed up for you. But first, the legality of cannabis use for medicinal or recreational use has always been different and controversial in many countries. Now, only two countries, that is Canada and Uruguay, have fully utilized its use. In many European countries, it is approved for medicinal use.
You're right, Wanjiku. And as we know, South Africa is the latest country to legalize its use for personal and private use. The highest court on the land, the Constitutional Court, ruled that it is no longer a criminal offense for adults to grow and possess cannabis, otherwise called weed, bang, all kind of names. The court has now given Parliament up to 2 years to amend all laws that criminalized its use and possession. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
This was the long-awaited ruling that many calling for private use of cannabis, otherwise known as dacha here in South Africa, were waiting for. Deputy Chief Justice Raymond Zondo delivered the verdict.
The effect of the judgment of this court is to decriminalize the use or possession of cannabis by an adult in private for that adult person's consumption in private. To decriminalize the cultivation of cannabis by an adult in a private place for that adult's personal consumption in private.
It's been a long journey for those calling for legalization of private use of marijuana. Gareth Prince, a Rastafarian lawyer, was arrested for being in possession of dacha in 1989 and fined €3 for that. This inspired him to start a fight for the legalization of dacha, often smoked by Rastafarians for religious reasons. In 2013, he and others applied to the Western Cape High Court and a judgment was made in his favor. However, the government challenged it, forcing the matter to go all the way to the Constitutional Court. And today, Prince was there to witness the landmark ruling along with other Rastafarians.
Today is a vindication for the Rastafari community, for the cannabis community, as well as for myself, in the sense that I am to be given the dignity and the respect that I, as a Rastafari, deserve, because I am an indigenous member of this country. So we are extremely thankful and joyful.
Although today's ruling legalizes using and cultivating of cannabis for personal and private use for adults, it does not decriminalize use of the drug in public, nor the offenses of supplying or dealing. Traditional Healers Organization of South Africa has hailed the court for its judgment. Here is Pepsile Masego.
And for healers, they should know that from today onwards, they can administer traditional medicine in a form of a cannabis. There's nothing that can stop us now to ensure that we provide this country with a health innovative solution in cannabis.
However, not all South Africans are happy with the judgment. Others fear this will worsen the country's problem of drug abuse. Cynthia Stolle is a South African based in Johannesburg.
I don't think it's a good move that South Africa has decided to make the smoke of marijuana legal. I think it's very bad. Already we see students stabbing teachers. There's a lot of crime, drug abuse, and this is going to make matters worse.
However, those choosing to use dacha have been warned to possess reasonable quantities, as they could be arrested if found with quantities, causing suspicion that they could be selling it. Adults found giving it to children could also be in trouble with the law.
To Sokumalo reporting from Johannesburg. And you have been giving us a comment. Uzoma Ichweku says, yes, in as much as we don't abuse it, many doctors have said it is a natural health benefit. Just like any other herbal medicines can be used in tea, he's saying it's okay.
Well, we have another comment here from Christian in Nigeria, and he says they're just trying to increase the rate of criminality. Do you think this is true? What do you think at home? You're listening to us. Write to us on Facebook, DW Africa. Let your voice be heard.
And Faroda Odo says marijuana should be only used for medical research, production, and the use for the treatment of diseases, not direct consumption.
And Tin Man says Kenya under President Uhuru should decriminalize it at least. Tourism will get the much-needed rebound from recent loss of business due to terrorism, considering the new direct flights from the States. Tin Man there has a very packed comment there.
Yeah, so thank you very much for the comments and join in the debate.
Africa on the move.
Now, power outages are still a common occurrence in the Gambia. That is despite some slight improvement in electricity grid in recent months. As you can imagine, power cuts lead to many inconvenient situations, such as dark streetways and also increased insecurity.
And this is one reason that is motivating youth living in the small village outside the Gambia's capital, Banjul, to install streetlights. They want to fight crime, and they are doing so in a unique but simple way. Omar Wali went to Lamin Village and now brings us this report.
Lamin, located 20 kilometers outside Banjul, is one of the villages often affected by Gambia's chronic power outages. With no power at homes and no street light, walking in the dark is part of life here. But one area of the village which has been known for drug abuse and crimes is finally enjoying street lights. The young people in Vexiat community embark on a project called Light of My Community to install street lights and to improve the image of the community. Ibrahim Abba, one of the youth leaders, explains the role of the streetlight in combating crime.
It has reduced crime rate drastically. I can give you an example. There was this young girl who was walking in one of the streets with her mobile phones, and two young boys were behind him and they tried to steal the mobile from him. And what happened was there was a man behind them from a distance who was able to see them due to the streetlights. And when this boy took the mobile phone from this young girl and started running, the man ran after them and caught the boys and took the mobile, and then the boys were later taken to the police and delivered to the police. If not for the bulbs, if not these streetlights were on the streets, it would have been very difficult to cut those kids.
This project has been successful because the youth have mobilized people and sensitized them on the importance of lighting. This is necessary. Although the youth are doing a manual work, the electricity is being provided and paid for by landlords who have houses along the streets. Ibrahim again.
We go to the household members, talk to them that we are on a project trying to fix lights to various locations, strategic locations that we allocated. So we talk to the compound holders or the family head there. With their consent that we need, we'll fix the bulb at their own cash power to the nearest switch at the house, or we create a special switch for it. So that's how we do the con. So when we come for the installation, we fix the bulb to the cash power of the compound owner, we create a switch for it, and the responsibility of the compound owner is to on the light when it's after Maghrib prayers, that's like 7 in the evening, and in the morning and off it.
Looking at our streets before, the place was dark. When it's dark, you don't have that freedom, and there's that risk of you being attacked. So looking at it now, I can say people are much more free. It's like daytime. You can't separate the day and the night. It's almost the same thing. You can move about freely without being at the risk of being attacked by someone.
13 months after the first street lights were installed, members of the Vexiat community are pleased about the project.
Now that there are different tribes within the area here, but they have that common goal. They have that liking. They will like one another. So you will find out that nobody is saying that this is black or red or pink or whatsoever. Oh, I am a fuller. I am a Mandinka. We don't have that here. And whosoever wants to bring that here, we are going to kick against you, because that is not going to help. There are some people, they are not trying to go leave this country. They want to develop everything. They want to get everything in their own country. They want to be part of the government, the people who are developing this country.
During his Meet the People's tour earlier this year, President Adama Barrow promised to install streetlights in some parts of the country. But here in Vexiat community, the people are looking for simple and faster to provide their own streetlights.
That is Omar Wale reporting from The Gambia.
Now, we asked you on Facebook, what would you do for your country? You see, this youth are doing something for their community. And we got very interesting comments. David from Nigeria said, how can I wake up or go to sleep thinking of what I will give to a country that does not care for her citizens' lives and right as a human being?
Yeah, that is quite another outlook. I think everyone has got something to do for their country. And Douglas says, good initiative. They are talking about that one from The Gambia. And he says, we do so similar things, small things in our communities. It is very good. Let us support ourselves for others to benefit.
And Ibrahim Jallo says, it's a good move for the youth of The Gambia to be making this step.
Focus Europe.
Now, here, back to Europe, where tensions between Germany and Turkey are easing after more than a year of relations being on ice. Last year, Turkish authorities arrested German citizens, Berlin threatened sanctions, and politicians in Ankara made comparisons to the Nazis.
Diplomatic ties are warming, though, and later this month, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan will visit Berlin at the invitation of German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Dorian Jones has more from Istanbul.
It was all laughter and smiling faces early this month when German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas met his Turkish counterpart Mevlut Çavuşoğlu in Istanbul. They were attending a ceremony to mark the 150th anniversary of the founding of the city's German school. Education is a good barometer of German-Turkish relations. Earlier this year, Turkish authorities shut down a German school in the city of Izmir when bilateral ties hit rock bottom. And the development of a Turkish-German university in Istanbul is firmly on the back burner after a year of high diplomatic tensions. But Ankara is facing a rupture in ties with Washington, which has triggered a financial crisis. And that means Turkey is trying to rekindle its relations with Berlin, according to Sinan Ülgen, head of the Istanbul-based İDAM think tank.
There indeed seems to be a warming of relations between Turkey and Germany. Turkey's relationship with its other big partner in the West, primarily the United States, is under tension. So there is a real willingness in Ankara, it seems, to improve the relationship with key European countries and primarily Germany, but not only Germany. We have seen efforts to normalize the relationship with the Netherlands. We have seen also an outreach to France.
Police recently broke up a peaceful protest by a group of mothers demanding to know what happened to their loved ones who disappeared at the hands of security forces. The spectacle of old women, some in their 70s and 80s, being dragged away by police is a stark reminder of how bad human rights have become in Turkey.
Free Turkish media! Free Turkish media!
In Berlin, human rights group Amnesty International has organized protests over the ongoing detention in Turkey of over 150 journalists, a world record. An Austrian journalist was detained in Ankara on terrorism charges. The Turkish authorities dismiss any criticism as propaganda and insist they're defending democracy. The value of the Turkish lira has plummeted and the country is facing a financial crisis. So Ankara is now looking to the EU, and in particular Berlin, for financial support. Turkey's leaders are banking on European fears that the country is simply too important to fail, especially as it remains a gatekeeper to refugees seeking to enter Europe.
Dorian Jones with that report from Istanbul. And Wanjiko, on our Facebook post about legalization of private use of cannabis in South Africa, people are still talking about it.
Yes, indeed. Ngor Divine says a spliff is less harmful than the cigarette. Remember, coffee was also once considered illegal. And that is indeed true. In Sweden, for example, it was banned in 1746. They thought it was a bad thing.
Oh, that is another outlook, yeah, for
yes,
sure.
Yes, indeed, that's all we've had time for today. My name is Onjiko Mwaura.
And I'm Zipora Nyambura. Bye for now.
DW. Made for Minds.